stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 organizing committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Every day, Inas gets on this boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis. Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkhe and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried lands. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan, in the province of Khuzestan.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him is very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages.
The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved a second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Forizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States, at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe. The floods you've mentioned, the droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Prophetess Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on this day, July 25th, 7 years ago, while marking International Quds Day, members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria were attacked by the military. Now, three of the sons of the organization's leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, were killed along with many of his followers. Then a year later, members of the organization were attacked again, killing at least 1,000 of them, with many others being arrested during the Zaria massacre. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were wounded and arrested, then and still remain illegally incarcerated. The question is why? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
On July 25th, 2014, Nigerian soldiers attacked in an International Quds Day rally in the northern city of Zaria by opening fire at people holding a peaceful demonstration. At least 32 people were killed in the attack and many more were injured. The rally was organized by the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, led by the prominent scholar Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sheikh Zakzaki has been an outspoken critic of the Nigerian government and its relations with Israel. He lost three of his sons following the attack. One was shot during the rally, and the other two were arrested and later killed by the army along with other detainees. The day following the attack, three truckloads of soldiers went to the Hosseiniyah Baqiyatullah, the headquarters of the Islamic Movement, and carried out yet another assault. Nigerian soldiers raided the place and bombed the mosque. Three people were killed, and dozens of others were wounded. Sheikh Zakzaki asked people to remain calm and called on the government to investigate the incident and bring those responsible to justice. But instead, another bloodbath took place. In December 2015, Nigerian soldiers attacked a religious ceremony organized by the IMN. The army claimed that they had responded to an attempt to assassinate Nigerian Chief of Army staff. The movement roundly denied such allegations. One day later, the army, using machine guns and tanks, attacked the movement's headquarters as well as the homes of members of the IMN. The extrajudicial killing left over 1,000 people dead.
They inhumanely massacred over 1,000 innocent people, among them 297 women, 23 of them pregnant.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were shot and injured during the crackdown. They were taken into a custody instead of a hospital. Nigerian authorities claimed that they had detained a cleric to protect him from violence. The government later outlawed the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Many members of the IMN believe that all these attacks against their movement have been pre-planned.
Past 20 years, these people had been planning more attacks on the Islamic movement.
Since the attack, Sheikh Zakzaki has been in jail without any charge or trial. The imprisonment is despite a court ruling in 2016 ordering his release. Members of his family said that Sheikh Zakzaki's health condition continues to deteriorate in detention.
Their health continues to deteriorate as they were terribly injured during the massacre. And that has also continuously to be neglected by the government, which has led to the Sheikh having multiple strokes and Malama could barely walk due to her ailing conditions.
Several human rights groups have expressed concern about Zakzaki's health situation and have called on the international community to intervene. They say the continued detention of the cleric and his wife without any charge violates all acceptable human rights standards. Even though there have been massive protests across Nigeria and the world calling for the release of Sheikh Zakzaki, the religious leader is still in detention. His followers, however, are not standing idly by and have vowed to continue pressing their demand for justice and the release of their leader.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Masoud Shajere from Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran. And Sohaila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki out of Mashhad. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it. I'm going to start it off with Sohaila, and I really appreciate you coming on the program. Can we start off, Sohaila, and just give us an update as to what's going on, how your parents are doing, and the current legal situation that they're facing?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, the general situation with my parents at the moment is that they have been in detention over the past almost six years now, and they have been moved recently to a general prison, and they have been there for about nearly 2 years now. And their health continues to deteriorate, generally because they have some health concerns without the attack, but also because they were injured during the attack in 2015. As for the court issue, so basically when they were kept in detention from 2015 towards in December, after the case was taken to the court and Federal High Court in Nigeria decided to rule that the case was their detention was illegal and that they should be released unconditionally, the government decided not to follow that. And after about over a year from that ruling, they decided to, charge them with certain things in a different court. Now, if one were to read the charges that they were charged with in this current court thing that is going on, it's quite silly, actually. They're charged with apparently culpable murder, and apparently they instigated hundreds of people to go and kill one person. That's what they are saying. And even though they did claim all that stuff, when the court sessions were happening, they didn't bring anything substantial to the case. And so a no-case submission was filed, and now we're waiting on what the judge will do on that by the 28th of this month. Hopefully, we'll get a favorable ruling in that regard.
We're all very hopeful. Masoud, let's look at the overall situation. I mean, do you think there has been added sensitivity towards the Islamic movement in Nigeria due to their massive presence on Quds Day and condemning the Israeli regime? Because I want to go back to this day, July 25th, of course, 7 years ago, which was International Quds Day. Is there added sensitivity because of the group's support for the Palestinian effort, you think?
Absolutely. And, not just Palestinians, but also the Saudis have been actively involved because the Sheikh has been supporting Yemenis and indeed Palestinians and everyone else who's been oppressed. Islamic movement have been very vocal against injustice, both internal in Nigeria and external. He's been critical of corruption. He's been critical of injustices that are taking place. And that has made him extremely unpopular with the government, but extremely popular with people. Islamic movement enjoys something in the region of 20 million supporters and something in the region of 20 million active members and 5 million supporters. And during the last 5-6 years, that support has increased. There are people saying that the only one who really cares for the people in Nigeria who is honest, and he calls us as it is. The situation in Nigeria is Sheikh Sakzaki. And this is not just members of movement, and this is not indeed just Muslims. Christians are actually see him as a figure which is hope for the future of Nigeria.
Okay, and well, let me get Sohaila. I want Sohaila to talk a little bit about the overall makeup of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, because we know that authorities have been trying to tarnish the image of the group, saying that the group is violent, dangerous. Your take on, and tell me the makeup of the group and the philosophy behind the group, according to what your father had led the group.
Yeah. So, well, the Islamic movement itself did start about 40 years ago, and the general set of ideas that drive the Islamic movement is primarily, basically opposing all oppression and also trying to bring forth a system that isn't, remnants of what basically we have a system in Nigeria that doesn't work. That doesn't work because since colonialism and also currently we have a lot of corruption. And from the beginning of the Islamic movement, the Frontura Declaration, which my dad delivered a speech that is titled that, which basically is the general ideology of the movement, is that we, as Muslims in that regard, since it is an Islamic movement, need to actually turn to Islam for, how to go about our lives. And ultimately, with the country at large, we have to have a system that does not, that is not like against our way of life, right? So that's the general idea of the Islamic movement. And since the start of the Islamic movement, the activities that have been carried out have been for the betterment of generally people there. And that is why there is such large amount of support. If you look at the makeup of the people in the Islamic movement, you'll find all kinds of groups of people. You'll find, academics, you'll find, students, you'll find all kinds of workers, you'll find just the most every kind of group of people you can think of in the society, you'll find them as a part of that. And you'll find the activities being much centered around the development of what we have, the situation we have, trying to better that, right? Trying to enlighten people, trying to educate people on their rights, on how we are being oppressed generally in so many ways, and what is the solution for that? That's the general activities of the Islamic movement. That's what they entail. And so all of the ideas that, all of the stuff that the government keeps spreading about the Islamic movement being violent or being terrorist, it's unfounded because, at the very least, you'd think that they would have something to base their, claims on, but there's nothing like that. There's only, if you went across the street, everywhere in Nigeria and speak with people who are familiar with the Islamic movement, you wouldn't hear such things. So that's about it, I think.
Okay. Well, in general, Masoud, why do you think the Sheikh is still in prison? I mean, we know that his release was ordered back in, from one of the courts back in 2016. What is the overall goal?
Well, the court that ordered his release against the accusation, which is actually almost exactly the same accusation as that he's being held now, was the highest court in land. And then afterwards, the government was in contempt of court. They didn't appeal the decision. As a matter of fact, the court said that his arrest is unconstitutional, and he asked the government to pay penalties to him and his wife and provide the accommodation since they destroyed his house. And the government ended up being in contempt of court, and then a lower court charges the same sort of accusation. It is unbelievable. And, this accusation that he has encouraged others to murder, and there were around 200 and odd people sort of charged for acting and murdering. Every single one of them was found not guilty. No evidence was presented against them. And indeed, the courts that we have been going through, this kangaroo court, which has to come to a decision on 28, has failed to bring any witnesses forward to actually prove that Sheikh Zakzaki has done anything wrong whatsoever. And this is why we feel that now that the sort of whole episode of court hearing after court hearing, delay after delay, now the judge has to make a decision. And, you know, you're referring
why do you think he has to make a decision this time around? Why do you think he won't delay it again?
Because the prosecution has exhausted all their sort of witnesses, and they haven't proven anything whatsoever. And the lawyers for the sheikh and the muallima are now saying that this matter needs to be thrown out of the court. Rightly so, because nothing has been proven. If nothing has been proven now, if nothing was proven in 2016, as a matter of fact, the only thing was proven that he was not guilty. So really, the judge has got no option but to pass this verdict. And if he doesn't, it shows that this is really just totally a kangaroo court. And they are just trying to delay after delay when everyone knows what's going on. And indeed, it was proven in the court.
Well, Sahela, what about the other side of the coin? Has anyone been charged or held responsible for the killing of Islamic Movement of Nigeria members? We know both in 2016 and 2017 that they were attacked and continue to be attacked when they've been protesting. So has anyone, any of these military personnel been charged or are serving time for these crimes?
I mean, you would think so, but unfortunately not. Even the case in 2014, which is 7 years today, there's no one that has been charged or is being punished for what was done, even though at the time the government said they would look into the case and figure out what happened and punish whoever is responsible. And of course, in this case, they're not even addressing that. Not only did they ignore it, they ignore the crime of the military, they went ahead and declared the Islamic Movement a terrorist group, and so therefore, I guess, you know, consider us no longer people who have any form of rights. So yeah, that's unfortunate that nobody is being held accountable for that to this day.
What about that, Masoud? I mean, you're from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. How are they able to get away with that, committing murder in mass and not holding anyone responsible?
Mazia is astonishing. I mean, I went to Nigeria a few days after, 7 years ago, after the massacre of Al-Quds Day. And what happened, you know, I did the investigation. What happened was the demonstration was actually finished. The tail of the demonstration was attacked at the last minutes by the military, who arrived from another part of the Nigeria, I believe Abuja, and arrived late and attacked the demonstrators and killed people, massacred them. And, you know, even bystanders, you know, there was a Christian person who actually hid in the shop trying to protect herself, and she was shot through the shutters and so forth. And you know, a beggar was killed. It was really a, you know, massacre. And, you know, the children of Sheikh Zakzaki, the three who were murdered, and the Ali, which was injured, these were arrested, and then they were shot you know, they just put the gun to their legs and shot them, shattered their bone, and put them, dropped them in a van and take him down there. It was really, it was very, very clear. And evidence and witnesses, which I interviewed and I put it on record, really was very clearly this was a murder, massacre, and using power by the military. And you know, when you go down to the sort of 2015, when that happened, some media went to shape and they said, they killed three of your children. What are you going to do? Are you going to take arms? And Sheikh Tehran famously said, no, truth is the weapon we're going to use to fight, and the due process. And you know, this is a man who had, who has millions of supporters, and he didn't want to take the law in his own hand.
Okay, stay with me, Masoud. Stay with me. Sorry, let me get Sohaila in on this. Sohaila, what Masoud just said, that the about truth will basically show itself, and I want to look at that, because with that being said, and him promoting actually the opposite of what the claims are against him, that he's violent, with the opposite of that being true, did you expect more from international humanitarian organizations or human rights organizations to get involved and to condemn what is happening and the continued imprisonment of your parents?
Well, yeah, of course we did. We still do hope that, you know, more people would actually speak about it. And it's really, it's crazy that there's not as much people speaking about it, because it's not really the most normal thing that you hear about a military in a country go and kill their own citizens, and then not just once, do it, you know, many times over, and not enough people are speaking about it and not enough people are paying attention to it, even though there are issues that are much smaller in comparison in terms of how atrocious they are, that are being addressed all the time by a lot of international bodies and things like that. So it's definitely very disappointed and very disappointing. And we did hope initially, but you know, at this point, we kind of still hope that more people would do so. But I believe that, you know, whoever was going to speak about it have already done so. And yeah, it's kind of really unfortunate that not enough people did pay attention to the issue.
Well, what about that, Masoud? Why do you think that is the case? I mean, we have so many international human rights organizations that are continually condemning various governments or entities for oppression, for limiting human rights, being against democracy. Why aren't we hearing a whole lot, if anything, from these organizations?
Really, there's only one way to explain this, and this is the level of demonization of Muslims and Islam and Islamophobia and environment of hate that exists, which actually manifests itself in this sort of way. I mean, look, let's be very clear. The investigation of the government itself, on itself, you know, it came out with the fact that that there are mass graves, that they not just murdered people, they actually dumped them in mass graves. Even up to this day, many parents, many people, many loved ones, they're still waiting to get a closure on what happened to their loved ones. And nothing has been done. They admitted that there is mass grave. We know where the location of every single of those mass graves. In the report that we sent to international court, we highlighted all these and the name of everyone who's been massacred. And, you know, they have opened the file, still the investigation going on. But despite all that, international human rights organizations like Amnesty and so forth, only echoing what already the Nigerians accepted, which is over 350 to 400 people killed. And they don't go beyond that. They don't even go beyond the fact that they admitted that there are mass graves. What should happen to this? Why the International Human Rights Organization, why the UN, why the EU, why the international community is not asking, where are these mass graves? Let's bring a closure at least on these things. Why do we have to have a situation that someone goes through the highest court in the land, find not guilty, and then take it to another lower court? I mean, this is not just abuse of power in Nigeria. This is abuse of the principles of justice.
Master, what has to happen? What has to happen, you think, right now? What needs to happen in order to see the Sheikh and his wife being released. 30 seconds.
Well, I think if they don't release, if the judge doesn't do the right thing on 28, then really there is no hope whatsoever this matter would be resolved within the Nigerian so-called due process. So we actually have to put tremendous pressure from outside. And I think what is really concerned for myself and other campaigners is the health of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife and the condition of the prison and the fact that we are going through a corona crisis and the fact that they need immediate medical attention. I think first of all, we need to release them, give them the medical attention, and then we need to look at what went wrong. For not just for the sake of those who were killed and shaheed and those who are injured and their lives destroyed, but for the future of Nigeria, because
okay.
This sort of abuse should not be not addressed.
And on that note, I would love to talk to both of you a lot more. And of course, we'll be following up. You said the 28th is the court, and of course, we'll be continually following that here at Press TV. Thank you both for being with me on this, the anniversary of the Quds tragedy. Masoud Shajadeh is from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran. Soheila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki out of Mashhad. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. It is. I'd better close the window and turn on the air conditioner. If you happen to decide to make an exciting trip, where would you travel? A cold, snowy mountain? The sea with a crowded beach? Or a green forest with a roaring river? All these destinations are good options for making an exciting trip, but I have a better choice. Let's make a trip to one of the hottest regions of the world, to Shahda Desert at the heart of Iran. Shahdad is a city located 78 kilometers from Kerman City. Northeast of the city of Shahdad, there is Shahdad Desert along with its kaluts. Kaluts are hills formed by wind or water erosion. The kaluts of Shahdad are the biggest and most unique kaluts of Iran, which are rarely seen anywhere in the world. Among the must-see marvels of this region are egg-shaped forms created in salty ground. Other astonishing marvels of Shahda Desert are vase-shaped sand dunes formed around vegetation called Nebka. Nebka is a plant hill formed when sand has gathered under the foot of plants, and eventually the root form a hill of sand with a plant crown on it. The height of each single Nebka as the highest desert vase-shaped sand dune reach about 10 meters and is considered as the rare flora of Shahda Desert. I am now at the heart of Shahda Desert, one of the most astonishing and beautiful natural attractions of Iran and the world. Here is one of the hottest regions of the world, and of course, a spectacular sight to visit. Oh, how calm it is here! The only sound you hear is the wind singing. I have come here to visit the Kaluts of Shahdad. Oh my God, what a stunning scenery! The Kaluts have created a fantastic atmosphere, as if it's a dreamy trip. While large Kaluts are formed by water and wind erosion, the small ones are only shaped by wind. Beside Shahda Desert Lake. This lake is called Javan. Actually, the existence of this lake at the heart of the desert is like a miracle. This natural lake was formed after flooding in the desert in April 2019. After the formation of Javan Lake, migratory birds have come to the lake for food and rest. However, it's really hot now, and I don't see any bird here. Oh my God, it's really hot in here. I have to come back to my desert eco-lodge. I will be back here at night for watching the stars. Watching the dazzling starry sky of Shahda Desert at night is one of the greatest events that can occur in anyone's life, and I don't want to miss this unique opportunity. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning.
Iran. IRIB English Radio.